I'm Mary Halst. I'm in my third year serving as the chaplain at Calvin College. I spent 8 years as a pastor here in Grand Rapids at Eastern Avenue Christian Reformed Church, where the worship style is a classic Reformed structure with a blend of contemporary and traditional elements. I wore a robe most Sundays. I preached from a manuscript every Sunday. I rarely uttered a word in a sermon that wasn't on my paper. And so one of the big things in my transition to preaching regularly here, now there was grad school in between, there was some time as a professor in between, but come on in. Close that actually if somebody wants to. So I had a little interlude in which I wasn't preaching every Sunday when I was earning my doctorate and when I was teaching. And it was one of the big draws of the job coming back and doing this was being able to preach every Sunday again. And I had preached at the Loft, which is the name of our Sunday night service. I had preached there on occasion when I was a pastor and then while I was in graduate school. I knew that I really enjoyed it, enjoyed preaching to this group, enjoyed how they stretched me, and I've only had that even more now serving as their pastor. It's been a real joy. So this is year three for me in this job. And I'm going to give you a couple of first delivery and presentational things that I've learned along the way, and then we're going to turn a bit to content, okay? And if at any time you got questions, you want to talk more about something, just throw up a hand and we'll cover it. And all my students in the room have the opportunity to correct me if at any point you say, no, really, we're not trying to teach you that. We're trying to teach you other things. So one of the things that I've never really used a lot in my preaching, but don't ever use now. A student can do a better presentation in about 15 minutes on her iPhone than I can do in 4 hours with a like fully maxed out computer. So I never learned really to preach PowerPoint. PowerPoint is much more for order and structure and business presentations. That's how it was designed. It wasn't designed for preaching. It's very rarely done well in sermons. And my students are submitted to bad PowerPoints regularly in classes, right? And so having them come to a worship space and say, once more, this is going to feel just like a lecture, and I've got 3 points, and you'd be taking notes, and there'll be a quiz at the end of the semester, it just doesn't fit. They just don't want that. So instead, what you'll see is some of the things that, for those of you who worshiped with us, is that we actually engage in different responses. So sometimes we'll have them write letters, like you all did, those of you who were at the service yesterday. Sometimes we'll have a big piece of paper up front, and they come forward and write prayer requests. At the end of last year, we had three big sheets of paper and said, how have you seen God at work in your life in this academic year? Just write a few sentences. And so then we sing songs and people come forward and they write. Or what are the things we've done? We've done put your hands in the bowl, wash your hands clean. Tying things to the tree, yep. So we have a big tree and then tie things to the tree during Lent. Say it again.
Garbage cans,
yep. So when I preached on the Philippians passage where he says, all things I count as loss, we actually wrote down things that were precious to us that were kind of idols and crumpled them up on paper and walked up and threw them into garbage cans as a symbol of saying, like, these things are actually done. When I preached one passage on Philippians, I had volunteers come up, and some people were the Philippians, and one person was Paul, and one person was God, and I moved them around to talk about the relationship that they had versus the relationship that Paul was inviting them to have. And so volunteers are big. When I did talked about David and his brothers, I had giant young men representing the brothers of David, and then I had a little boy who was 8 sitting in the back that no one knew, and I had him come up and be David and talk about the difference in call and how God chooses us. And so the use of props is big, the use of image, the use of movement, the use of volunteers, the use of responses, things that they're not going to get often in a regular worship service in a church, and they're not going to get in the classroom. So something that's going to be different, it's going to call out a different response to them. Yes?
Just really quick, how big each week are you, how many kids are you teaching?
About 500, 450 to 500.
It works for even larger.
Yeah, so if you've been in the chapel, it's a very mobile space, and we can do a lot with that space and have different stations in different places. So that works pretty well for most of the time. That's a good reminder. So the student body at Calvin is about 4,000 students. And about 20% are students of color or international students. About just under half come from a Christian Reformed tradition. Just over half come from a variety of liturgical and ecclesiastical traditions. Many come from non-denom churches. Many have their primary faith formation experience in a program like Young Life, as opposed to a program like a church. And so you have a big diversity. So I say the Christian school kids, which is a traditional draw for Calvin College, really know their theology well. They generally know their Bibles pretty well. They're less comfortable saying things like, hey, I've really been praying about this, or the Spirit said this to me, or I'm trying to work on this in my spiritual life. The evangelical community church kind of kids don't know their Bibles quite as well, don't know their theology quite as well, but much more comfortable talking about Jesus, talking about their prayer life, talking about spiritual growth. And so you have that big expanse to preach to on a Sunday, where some students are going to know, if I refer to Isaiah, they're going to know everything about Isaiah and who he was and where he lived and what his story was and his prophecy. And other students are going to go, Isaiah, I think that was Old Testament. Like, there's going to be that kind of spectrum, which many of you preach to as well. They're very engaged participants. Sloth is optional. There are lots of things they could be doing. They choose to come on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. So you're going to get students who want to be there, which is great. Come on in. Come on in. There's room. Yeah. So that's my context. Those are my students. Generally, at the beginning of the semester, there's a lot more energy. During interim, there's a lot more energy. So I've learned how in kind of between Thanksgiving and Christmas, when they all begin to shut down and get starry-eyed and sleep-deprived, that we need to demand less of them in worship in a way. So it's not like, now spend 10 minutes thinking really hard about your relationship with God. They're like, oh my God, right? But if we say, you know, it's communion, come forward and get some bread and some love, and they're like, yes. So that's, you kind of have to shape it for a community that by Thanksgiving, by early December, is, you know, just like hanging on by their fingernails, most of them. And the same in April, late April. We have that same kind of rhythm. They laugh a lot, which is a great group to preach to. They generally get my jokes and appreciate them, which is something that I really thank you all. They're very very kind in that regard. So I find that the more that we can interact with them and say that this isn't just a space where it's one more person standing up in front talking at you, but actually engaging with you. Sometimes I'll ask a question and anticipate a response. Sometimes I'll have a theme for a series that I'll say, what are we doing now? We're doing this. Even when I do the offering, we have the same offering every week, and it's for the Community Care Fund. And who is the Community Care Fund for? Us, yes. So they say that every week. Who's it for? Us. It's a fund by which students give to other students in need, and students can apply if they have a dental emergency that comes up, or sometimes we have an international student who needs a flight home. So the students all know that's part of our liturgy on Sunday. I tell them all the importance of giving, and they could probably say the spiel that I do every week. But that's what we do together. So it really shapes our community. So hopefully, even if you've never been in Loft before, you feel like, oh, this feels safe space. This feels like where I want to be. These people really love me. That's really what we want. Tyler actually said, all you have to do is tell them to end with hugs. Because that's what's the best part. So at the end of Loft, there's coffee and cookies in the basement. We all have prayer servants off to a side. And then I started that this fall. I go to one of the doors and I just give hugs to everybody as they leave. I realized I had a student who came up to me early after school started. He was a first year student. He was feeling really lonely. And he said to me, I just, can I have a hug? He says, no one's hugged me since I've been here. And I thought, wow. You know, and when you're dealing with the 18 to 22-year-old population who is doing such a good job of controlling issues around chastity and things like this, and for them to be in a touch-deprived culture doesn't help when they're really trying to live a godly life around those issues. And so that, and because I realized as a pastor that one of my best times was always after worship, when I got to shake hands with people and look them in the eye and ask about the, you know, how's your whatever is going on in your life. And so that's been a really great thing for me afterwards. I hug them and tell them that they're loved, and get to follow up with some of them. And so that's been a pretty great time. Tyler loves it. Marie, you're good? Jess? Yeah? Others? Good? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. My arms are, most people are taller than I am. So I have to stretch my shoulders afterwards, but it's a small price to pay. So we try to create a community that's really for them, gives them safe space, and is unlike a lecture or a classroom, which is why the PowerPoint doesn't work. So you saw, Randy, you had a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. I don't use PowerPoint, but occasionally, rare occasions, I will project something.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about that.
Yep. Every now and then I projected things. Do you guys remember anything that I projected? Putting you on the spot. Little quiz.
Kind of like the images of beauty.
Yep. Images of beauty. When we talked about Abigail and beauty, Craig, do you ever?
Remember, I don't know how many years ago when you had done the saints who have gone before us, you showed pictures of some of them.
Yes. Pictures of saints who've gone before. When I did a baptism message a year ago, I used an image of one of our resident directors had just had a newborn baby. And I projected a couple of images of her and one of him holding her and talking about what baptism is and what it means and why they would want to do this for her. So if I feel like an image really moves the message forward, I will use it. Words rarely, and sometimes I'll put a quote on the screen that I really want them to get, especially if it's a long quote. When I did the Lord's Supper sermon last year, I had a long quote from John Calvin that we put on the screen. So that kind of thing, if it enhances the message, but just a basic bullet point thing. Because anytime you give somebody an outline, particularly if you give them the whole outline, all they're thinking of was, when do you get here? I don't really care about that. When do you get here? Which is also why I say don't hand out outlines to people, because as soon as they're done filling in the blanks, their brains are done too. So that's free. No extra charge for that one. Yeah, so what did I say? Film clips without sound. I did a, I used the film Miracle, the hockey film, which if you haven't seen, it's great film. And I used it during Lent to talk about how it feels sometimes like God is the coach who's saying, again, 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 you need to do more, you need to do more, you need to do more. And then counter that with what Isaiah says, like, no, you're done. Like, you've been paid. It's all been paid. It's really done. But even to just, I had the words just when he was saying again, again, and he blows the whistle again. They have to skate again after they've lost this game. And it was just a really strong image, and then to come through the rest of the sermon. So Jeff Mannion, who preaches locally here at Ada Bible Church, will use film clips without any sound too. To just say, do you remember this scene? And that allows you to be the voice that's talking. Because often if you play a film that everybody's seen, what do they keep thinking about after they keep thinking about the movie, right? They don't really care about you. So I kind of, my guide on that is if it's an unfamiliar clip, for example, I had a student in a preaching class use a clip of a Marine talking about Psalm 91, which none of us had seen. So it was really powerful. He used it early in the message. But it's a film that everybody's seen, or 90% of people have seen. Just reference it. Don't show it. That's kind of how I use images. I have great graphic designers and students and people that I can say, what would you think if we did this, the worship apprentices? What would you think if we did that? How would that work? That helps me to keep things focused, and that's not my gift area, is graphics or images or PowerPoint or any of that. So know your gift area.
Yeah,
So I know for some of you this causes you to hyperventilate even at the thought of preaching without notes. By the way, for the recording, the first thing was get rid of PowerPoint, and the second thing is preach without notes, in case anyone ever listens to this. So I preached a manuscript when I was at Eastern Avenue, and that came out of a speech class I had here at Calvin, one of the best classes I've ever taken, where the teacher walked us through different ways of doing speeches, one from note cards and one from a full manuscript and one with nothing, and we had to do each time. And the time that I preached with note cards was easily my rockiest. I just thought, when I get off, I can really go off, you know, grammatical train wrecks and thoughts that had never come up before suddenly coming out of my mouth. And can I have a witness, right? We've all, right? Especially when you're tired and you're just like, come back in my mouth. So I always used a manuscript because I knew that was tight, it was controlled, I was disciplined, it really helped me stay focused. But in the context I'm in, particularly at preaching in the round, and it helps so much to have immediate connectivity with the people I'm talking with. There's no moment where I'm looking down and not thinking about them, not thinking about how to connect with them. The first few times, I will admit, super anxious, just super anxious. I'd spend the whole first third of the service just going over the sermon in my head. And then I say this, and then I move here, and then I do that, and then I do this. And it just was so anxiety-producing. Because what I was doing was actually writing my sermons the same way I had been before, writing out a full manuscript, then trying to memorize the full manuscript, and then trying to say the full manuscript. And so what I've learned to do in the last few years is to, my writing is actually different. I write so that I can remember it. So I write more in concepts and in focused lines and in movements. So a big key to preaching without notes is to give your body ways to help you remember what's next. So kinesthetic memory, very important. So if you saw me preach, it was like you don't walk, you don't stand, you don't sit, right? So that was our thing. And that I could keep coming back to that and say, oh, when Jesus redeems us, he takes us from here to here, right? So my body's helping to remember it. The other thing is, the Psalm 1 sermon was a walk through the text kind of sermon. So those are the best, because then you're like, oh, did I talk about this? And then I want to say, right, the Psalm helps you out. This is where I want to go. But I'll have gestures that I'll do for certain things. Like, I knew that when I was going to talk about the note, I was going to do this. And so what else do I say when I talk about the note? I talk about relationship. I talk about this. The reach in your back and pull out the wall, right? Just tree. I knew it was going to be big. So when you're practicing the sermon, the more you get your body involved and the sooner you get your body involved, even in the writing and crafting of the sermon, the easier it is for you to remember. And I used to beat myself up because invariably I would sit down after it and go, oh, I forgot that part. Or that was a great line and I didn't say it. And you just have to realize that that's ego, right? That is just pure ego. Like, I was going to impress you with my great word smithing there. I had this beautiful line. It was poetic and alliterative and it was just great. And you missed it. It's like, they don't care. They don't know what they missed. What they know is, did the sermon flow from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing? So what I've learned to do too is really release it. To say, by the time, my general schedule is Saturday is really when I work on the sermon. So I work on Saturday mornings from 9 until about 2, and that's when I do a bulk of the writing and crafting and research and commentaries and gathering thoughts. And then I set it aside until Sunday at 2. And then from Sunday at 2 until Sunday at about 7 is finalize, get it together, memorize it, walk through it, get the kinesthetic, work out all the kinks. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to do this. Here's where I'm going to do this. And then I just practice it 3 times. All the way through 3 times at least. And then by the time I get to worship, I can really worship because I think this is in the bank. My body knows it. And when the time comes, we're going to be okay. This doesn't mean that I still don't leave some things that I think I should have said. It doesn't mean that I still don't say things that I wish I wouldn't have. And it also is a high time investment. right? Let's not joke around about this. If you've got a manuscript and you know all I have to do is say the words on the page, you can go in the pulpit, and worst case scenario, all you're doing is reading the words on the page, right? That's like, if you have to, if it's Saturday night at 10 o'clock and, you know, that's the first thing to go is delivery, right? Because we're like, look, people, my thoughts are good. Take them as they come. And so it's a high investment, but I also think it's a high return. And it's a high return, I think, not just for those people who have to listen to me, but it's a high return for me because the whole time I'm preaching, I'm reading responses. How is this going over? Do I need to take a minute and slow it down? And even pastorally, I can say, oh, there's a student who's got tears in her eyes right now. Do I know the student? Who is she sitting with? How can I be sure that she's getting well cared for in the moment? Or you're just able to read the context in the moment so much more than if I was constantly thinking about, oh, I'm to this page and now I need to flip. So that's been the advantages that I've really seen in this. Some of the challenges now are when I'm invited to preach at a place like a tall steeple church where it's robes, and then I feel really constrained because then I think I should really preach a manuscript. I should really, you know, not move around. I can't move around a lot. Literally, some of these pulpits, you know, you literally can't move around a lot. And then I always feel like I'm, you know, like, because I'm just so trained to this is how we do preaching now. Questions, comments, thoughts? Doug?
Yeah, I'm curious. Topic of this is what my students taught me. Have you gotten feedback that without notes is a good idea?
Yeah. No, it's great. Tyler, Marie, Jess. I'm sorry, I can't remember your name.
Jeff,
excellent. Jeff, weigh in. What do you think?
I agree with what you're saying.
What do you observe?
I feel like when you do, like you really connect with us and I can make eye contact with you while you're preaching, and at certain points that, like, for some whatever reason, whenever I really feel like the message is pertaining to something to me, you always end up making eye contact with me at some point. Oh, man, she knows. But yeah, it's good. It makes it more personalized for us.
Yeah. And that's exactly what... Go ahead. Go ahead, Heather or Marie.
I was just going to say, I bring my 13-year-old to law, and she connects with you. I mean, she feels like you're talking to her.
From the manuscript to get it in your body, but... Do you write anything down? In preparation, help us get from
Great question. So I find that if I can start it off well, I'm good. But figuring out my introduction has always been the biggest challenge for me. And so I have a good idea of where I'm going to go. And so what I'll often do midweek, I'll kind of know what the sermon topic is and where we're going. Well, we have it all charted out for the year, but I'll have a good idea of what the worship apprentices have built around the idea and concept and what the response they're going for. And so I have a big theme in my head. And so usually Saturday morning is a lot of wrestling about, is there one big image that I'm going to use? Is there one... big question that I'm going to answer. And if I can figure out the introduction, and that happens for me, sitting my butt in the chair in front of my computer, trying different things to say, does this get me where I want to go? Does this get me where I want to go? If I can get the introduction really cemented down well, then I know my moves from there. So then I can take the ball and say, my manuscripts now are like, fully worded, fully words, lots of paragraph, and then it kind of flips down to like paragraph, idea, movement, illustration. And then my conclusion is the other thing that I really try to work hard on. Because I find that preaching without notes, the biggest challenge is how do you land the plane? Because I could keep talking, right? I got lots of things to say to you all. And so it's how do I land the plane? How do I finish this off? So my introduction and my conclusion are for sure written out. And then some of the internal structure is a little looser. Yeah, Craig.
Did you enjoy pushback? I am not in a church with only college students.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I am in a church that is fairly old.
Yep.
Very traditional.
Yep.
The screen is a brand new thing. Many of our members do not have email. Does this transcend, or is this a generational thing?
I think it transcends. I think preaching without notes, when I've done it in other contexts too, it's been really well received for the reasons that Jeff gave. Yes, Phil, and then
I can answer
Brett.
That because I don't preach with notes, and the happiest people are the 80-year-olds.
I would agree.
In the church.
I put them all in little sticky notes. They tease me because I have all these little sticky notes along with my Bible, which I rarely use, but somehow it makes me feel better to
yep, to have you get the little, yes,
there. The flow
yes.
is the big piece.
Yeah. So move there from manuscript to note cards to post-it notes. That may be a way for some of you to go. I will say, though, you can do it. And you don't know that you can do it until you actually try it. You know, it's really, you have to actually fly without the net. Like, really try it without any notes. Take a flyer. And you could even say to your elders, hey, I'm going to try something new, and I need some prayer coverage on this because my anxiety is going to be really high. And I just want you to see, don't tell people that I'm doing it, just see what people notice. The first few times it was very anxiety producing, but I the results were so immediate that I thought, this is worth the effort. No. Yeah. Oh, the introduction. What do you try to do in an introduction? What you try to do in an introduction is make it interesting to keep listening, right? So you either tell a story that shapes things up, or you ask a big question, or sometimes the text is really troubling and everyone says, the word of the Lord, thanks be to God. And you say, really? Really? Are you thankful for this word? Because this doesn't seem like something I'd be very, right? So just make it so that they're like, where is she going to go with that, right? So I don't even know if anybody remembers my introductions. But there's a sense where you want to say, when I've been looking at this text, here are the questions that I've had. And I'm going to guess that they're your questions too. So come on and let's look at this together. So very invitational, raise the interest level. You know, we live in a culture where if we don't like something, we can change it immediately. If I don't like what's on television, I can change the channel immediately. Same thing with the radio. Same thing with the phone or email. Like, the power I have to control my environment has never been higher than it is right now in some aspects, particularly around words coming at me. So if you live in a culture where people get voted off the island really quickly, and students are very aware of, like, voting for American Idol, voting for these kind of things. Like, if you don't earn their attention in the first 2 to 4 minutes, you're not getting it back, right? You're just not. So, yes.
I was thinking this morning about how Jesus helped how people gathered around being vulnerable.
Depending on the flexibility of the furniture and the flexibility of the congregation. And honestly, the furniture may be way more than the other. Even turning the pulpit at an angle can give you open space. Even moving it forward if it's way back so that you're actually closer to the people that you're talking to in such a way that it's like, well, hello, we can't help but have an intimate conversation because I'm right here. If there are things that you can do with your congregants to, say, rope off the 5 back rows so they're forced to sit toward the front. Just say, and this is how you learn how to do things in ministry, where you say, we're going to try this for 1 month. We're just going to try roping off for Lent. We're just going to try and see, do you like, because if you put a time frame around it, then people are like, oh, well, we're only doing this for Lent. And then you start to have people go, oh, actually, I like this. Like, can we keep this? Those are ways to think about the space.
Do you trust yourself to articulate that inspired idea that occurs halfway through that you haven't?
Oh, yes. Yeah, because sometimes the Holy Spirit does halfway through the sermon say, and now say that. And you're like, really? Because that wasn't in my original plan. That doesn't happen very often, although it happens sometimes. And the question you asked was, do I trust myself? The answer is no, heck no. No, I don't. And so if something like that comes in, because I know myself well enough to say, if it's funny, I'm going to want to say it. And if it's a cool story, I'm going to want to say it. And I don't have enough of a filter, usually, even in the best of times, to resist that. And so a lot of my prayer work about my sermon is, what do they need to hear this week? What do they need? Get me out of the way. And what do they need from you? And so as I'm preaching, and if there's something that comes into my head, I think in the second, you got to do the, all right, is this about me or is this about them? Is this helpful to them? Is Jesus Christ being glorified by? And that's a really quick thing to do in the moment, which is why generally I just don't, unless it seems really spirit-led and driven. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Hi, Mary.
Hey.
Your Psalm 1 sermon, you really pointed out the application.
Yeah, that's a great question. Usually my sermons run about 25, sometimes 30. There have been a rare occasion this fall when it was a 35-er. The symposium is very tight, particularly for those of you who are there in the morning, because they know the rest of the schedule has to go on. So I had to land the plane in 20 minutes. Like, I had to get there. Because otherwise, you know, Emily Brink and Kathy Smith are going, what are you doing? And you don't want that. You don't want to get on their bad side. And so so generally, they're right around 25 minutes. That's what I'm shooting for. With students, this is actually a great segue. Thank you. So the third thing is tell them why, not how. So a lot of, they used to print sermon titles in the paper fairly regularly, lots more than they do now that every church has a website. But if you just scroll through websites and scroll through it, you have a lot of like how to do this, how to manage your money, how to rear your children, how to find a marriage partner, I don't know what it is, how to be more meek, whatever the topic is. Students don't really care a lot about how until they know why. Why am I supposed to do this? Why are we called to do this? What's the theology behind this? What's the doctrine behind this? Why do we believe this stuff? And then once you can say together, this is why, this is what we learn from Scripture, and this is why, and then we talk about how. Then we talk about how does this why inform how we live? How does this idea inform what we do? How does God's action here inform our response? That's really important. Do you think that's accurate?
I think because we're told all week long like how to do something, then we're never told why, and so we're not going to listen to you if you just tell us how to do something else.
Yeah.
Right. You had a comment earlier too,
yeah.
Jeff.
It was to the how to make it more personal question. I know who my two favorite pastors are. One of them is right here, and the other one's in Texas. And Pastor Mary does not stand behind a pulpit. And so kind of think of a pulpit as it's really safe to speak behind a pulpit, right? You've got a wall right there in front of you between you and everybody that you're talking to. And it is a wall right there in front of you between everybody who's listening to you and you. And so moving around, like stepping not even behind the pulpit and walking around, like in front of the pulpit and walking down, taking a step down off the stage. The pastor that I'm thinking of, he's on a stage, like, and it's three steps down. He'll go to the front of the stage, sit down, and continue preaching. So you can make it personal in the setup that we have. It's just that the pulpit, and like the bigger, the more extravagant the pulpit, the bigger the castle that you're hiding behind as you preach, basically. And it can be a fantastic thing when you're really nervous, but it's not so amazing for everybody who's attempting to listen. So that would be my comment on that, is that maybe you don't have to completely rework the format of the church, but the format from which you're preaching.
Nice. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, and this can be like a four-week process. Like week one, you take like two steps out to one side, and, you know, and then like the week two, you take a step forward, and depending on how recipient, how much of a recipient you have in a congregation. So why, not how, is really important. Do you get that? Do I need to talk more about that, or you're good? All right. This can seem kind of obvious. Preach the Bible. Preach the Bible. You may think, well, students are reading all kinds of books. Don't they want to know about different things that are popping up? No, I really want them to know the Bible. I really want them to know the Bible. And when we preach, we're teaching people, this is how you handle Scripture. This is how you do it. And so I take a text and I work with the text. And I try and reveal things out of the text and say, this is what we hear. This is what the narrative is. This is what's going on. So hopefully by the time they've listened to me for a while, they really know Bible and they know how to deal with it and to say, well, this is how we do things. So my challenge for the spring, we're doing a series called Honest to God. Last November, I had everyone write on a card. If you're sitting across the coffee table from God, you have the opportunity to ask him one question. What do you ask him? Had them write them down on index cards. We collected them, put them all in kind of in categories and groups. And so this spring, I'm going to be preaching through those questions, which is a real challenge because then it's more topical preaching than textual. So my work this week is to frame it up and see the thing I'm going to do is figure out, is anybody in Scripture asked this question? Has this question been asked somehow in Scripture? And then we stand with the saints of all times and places. Because, you know, there are no questions that they have asked that have not been asked before. And so I want to remind them, like, you're not the first people to doubt. You're not the first people to wonder about the problem of evil or to figure out what is God calling me to do with my life. Like, these are old, ancient questions. They're legitimate, they're true, and we're going to answer them together. But know that you stand in a long history of people who've been looking at God and wondering about this stuff. And so I'm going to tie every one of those sermons to a scripture passage, not to 12 different proof texts, but to one passage. So we're going to look at this passage and see what it has to say. So I avoid topical preaching generally and really want to preach the Bible. Yes?
How far in advance do you know, like, what text you're going to preach on? Like, do you have the whole year of books, you know, like, saying I'm going to, or do you go, oh, hey, look what the lectionary says. Like, that one's fun.
For 2012, I know everything. So spring is Honest to God. That'll take us through. And for the fall, we're doing the Sermon on the Mount, which is our all-campus Bible study for the fall. So we did Philippians, we did Psalms, we're doing Sermon on the Mount, and we're trying to do different genres of biblical literature. So if you do all four Bible studies while you're here, you'll get a different genre of literature and figure out how to approach that. So that's another way where the campus-wide ministry that we're doing hopefully enhances and supports what we're doing on Sunday nights. Yeah?
Tom Long in a session earlier started talking about how we're entering a generation that wants to hear more episodic than narrative preaching. I'm wondering if students have taught you anything about that in terms of
how would he define episodic?
One good question. We didn't get far enough into it, so
you're saying instead of having this narrative where you're making one kind of big argument, you're trying to string people along the way through, or you get the aha moment at the end. I think you're kind of inductive.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure exactly, but nuggets along. He said, if you don't do episodic, whoever you find, people will make it episodic. So they'll talk about, well, this one section that's supposed to be a part of the whole, but they only get a story about them all or whatever it might be.
Right.
I think he was saying you need nuggets.
Need nuggets along the way. I think the longer you preach, the more that's true. The longer of time you preach, the more that's true. So if you listen to a sermon by somebody who preaches 45 minutes, usually there are three sermons in there. And if you're listening to somebody who's preaching 20 minutes, hopefully there's just one, and every illustration points back to that one big idea, the Haddon Robinson approach. So I don't know. I haven't actually asked that question of my students. What do you guys think? So generally I try to get one big idea across. The sentence would start with God. Usually God does something in our lives. And I think every illustration that I choose or every move that I make is always pointing to that one big idea. Is that coming across? You're good?
Yeah.
We usually have like one phrase.
Yeah, one phrase or refrain. Yeah.
But then along the way there usually are, just by nature, like nuggets that you'll pick out, like,
right
down.
Right.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's... I think it's a yes and. But I wouldn't write an episodic sermon. I wouldn't want to say, out of this section, I really want them to get X, and out of this section, I want them to get Y, and out of this section, I really want them to get one thing. Like, they have noise coming at them from all directions all the time. And so, if they have moments when they, like, tune out because their brain is just tired, or they're thinking about what's happening, or who are those people, and I want them to be able to come back in and go, oh, okay, all right, I'm good. She's still talking about the big idea. So I missed a cool illustration, or I didn't quite get what Paul said about X, but at least I'm still able to jump back in. So there are pros and cons about that. I would find it hard to write an episodic sermon. I think they're maybe incidental to narrative sermons. But I don't think, from what I've seen in them, they really like a big idea coming at them that they can kind of grasp and mull over and talk about later in the week. Jeff?
I guess what I think of when I hear narrative sermon is like a pastor standing up in front of me and being like, all right, so for the next month, we're going to be talking about this. And this sermon today is going to be laying the groundwork for that.
Right.
And as soon as those words come out of their mouth, it becomes about 1,000 times harder to listen to the rest of that sermon, because what he just told me is, this sermon really isn't that important, except that you're going to be here next week to hear about it again.
So, yeah.
I don't know. That's what I think of when I hear a narrative sermon.
Yeah.
This isn't dialogue about Tom, but I think one of the points that he was saying is that don't wait to do the aha moment until the end.
Oh, okay. Don't wait until do the aha moment.
I'm trying to remember, you know, sort of how you approached Psalm 1 yesterday. Because I thought you did it well, but in terms of getting that big idea across, how soon in the sort of development of the sermon would you like to do that?
Yeah. The Psalm 1 was actually pretty didactic and thematic, right? So it came up, here's the big idea, folks, and here we're going to unpack it. That's kind of rare, I think, particularly when you're, so I was preaching the story of David, and there you have to do so much setup of the context, and this is actually what God is doing in a story where God's name isn't ever coming up. And then it takes, because you have to do this unpacking, then you get the aha, and it's like, oh, well, the only way that made sense was if I knew this first. And so I think it really depends on the genre that you're, of biblical literature that you're preaching, teaching. And every now and then, you just really need to set it up before you can get the aha. And maybe there's one big aha. Or maybe there's like, here's the aha for those of you who are in this situation. Here's the aha for those of you in this situation. Here's the aha for those of you in this situation. But it's all like manifestations of the same kind of concept, just applied differently.
The other thing that we need to remember for those of us who were there is Lauren was talking specifically about epistolary service.
Oh,
and how you deal with.
Yeah. If you're preaching epistles, then all of your nuggets actually have to build off each other, right? You can't have a nugget that's about apples and then have a nugget about horseshoes, because people could be like, what? Which you often have in kind of the classic 3 points. Well, Paul's first talking about this, and then he talks about that, and then he talks about that. This is amen. I don't know. So, yeah, you want a string of pearls. You don't want like a picnic basket of stuff, right? So. Other questions? We're good? All right. Whoops. Another word, Mary. So 5 is challenge them. 1, get rid of PowerPoint. 2, preach without notes. 3, tell them why, not how. 4, preach the Bible. 5, challenge them. That, again, is for everybody listening. College students want someone to take faith seriously and invite them to take faith seriously, right? So it's like, if you're inviting us to lay down our lives for this, show us how you're doing it, and then give us ways in which we can do it. So I might challenge them by saying, who do you know in your life who's a non-believer, and what can you do this week to reach out to them? Or some of you are in roommate situations where it's not going well. What is one specific thing you're going to do this week so that as far as it depends on you, you're living at peace with everybody else. So really give them concrete ways to say, this is what it looks like to live out faith. This is, and that's, Calvin does that in 2,700 different ways across the campus, right? So so maybe you challenge them by saying, and I think I've done this within the last year and a half. I don't think I did it my first year. But the more I got to know my students who are high achievement, concerned about grades, really want to do well, really want to set themselves up for success, you know, there have been times when I've said, definitely in pastoral counseling, I don't know if I've said it in preaching, where give yourself the permission to get the B plus. Extend that grace to yourself. Can you challenge yourself to say, I'm not going to get the honors in this course, and I'm going to choose to be okay with that. Right? What's the challenge look like if you really lay your life down for the kingdom and it's not about ego? What does it look like if you say, I used this just a couple of weeks ago. I had a student who came to me and said, I realized that I chose my major because I knew it would make me money. And I'm realizing now that God's inviting me to look hard at that choice. So that's one student that I can bring in who's speaking into the other students' lives to say, well, why are you choosing your major? What are your goals? And so then it's less like Pastor Mary as mom saying, you guys need to get your crap together. And it's more like, this is what kingdom living looks like. And how do we do that well together? And what does it actually look like for you to make these big changes? One of the joys of working with college students is that if you actually challenge them to do something, they will do it. They won't just shake your hand at the back and say, that was a really interesting sermon. And thanks. I mean, they really will do it. If you have them in pastoral counseling and you say, you know, I really think you may need to think about it this way, you'll actually see light bulbs come on. And then they'll go, oh, I've never thought about it that way before. That's really helpful. So you really need to know what you're doing, in a sense, because you want to challenge them to move in the right direction. So comments on that from you people who've listened to me a lot about other challenges? Marie?
I have a comment. Just on it.
Tell them why, not how. Yeah, that's part of number three, too. It's the same kind of thing. You know, they really want faith that matters and is alive and is real, which is why someone like Shane Claiborne is really appealing, because there's somebody who listened, took the faith very seriously, and made significant changes in his life because of it. It's like, well, maybe I'm not called to be Shane Claiborne, but who am I called to be? What are the significant things that God's calling me to lay down? And they're realizing that they're coming of age at a time when most of them won't have as much stuff as their parents had. So it's like, well, where's my value going to be? And maybe there's a certain freedom in not growing into as consumptive of a culture and saying, Jesus Christ sets me free from that. That's great, you know. So I'm going to go to Ghana. I'm going to go to Honduras. And I'm going to spend a few years doing that. And it'll take me 30 years to pay back my student loans. But I think I'm spending my life in the right way. They really want to be called to spend their lives in the right way. And actually, I think most of our parishioners do. You know, they really want a gospel that matters. They really want a church that matters and calls them to do different things. I was on a Good World Tour for the college last week in California and was at a retirement home and was walking by, and not to make any judgments, but I was walking by a room that was set aside for card playing, and there are people just sitting in there in the middle of the afternoon just playing bridge, and you know, it's great, and I have no idea what they do with the rest of their time, but I thought, where's the spiritual leadership here saying, you have a Christian school across the street where these students desperately need Christian men and women to pour into their lives? And what would it look like if once a week some of you mentored some of those students? What would it look like if that community sent you prayer requests? And once a week you gathered as a retirement community and prayed? Like, how can we cross-fertilize here? Where are your congregations and where can they be challenged to do something that's really specific for them and their context? So my students are, they don't have a lot of money, they don't have a lot of time, but they have an incredible amount of creativity. They have an incredible amount of idealism. It's like, let's tap into that and let's really challenge them to change the world for the gospel of Jesus Christ, because I fully believe they can do it. And I think that gets to the next point. Believe in them. And by that I mean, like, treat them like adults. Treat them like people who are ready for this, who want to make a difference. You know, that I say, you know, I think that you can do this. I think that you can get sober. I think that you can stop using pornography. I believe that you can get a handle on your money. I think that you can talk to your parents about this. And I have had students that I've been working with, and they'll say, I'll do it if you'll go with me. Great. I'm in. Let's make the appointment. I will go with you and talk with your parents about this. I will go with you to the counselor, and we together, like, I will be with you in this because I believe so much in who you are and what God's trying to do in your life. And there again, that's what our congregations need. They need somebody who says, I believe in you. I believe in this place. I believe more in the gospel of Jesus Christ than in all the other crap that's in your life. And I think that's going to have some pretty amazing power. So let's go team, right? That's, and it's really fun, right? Because some people come and they've come from backgrounds where no one's really believed in them. No one's championed them. You know, maybe they were like the B-minus student in high school and then they had a learning disability diagnosed. And so now they're doing really well and realizing that they have this ability and this potential. And for the first time, people can believe in them. Or for the first time, no one knows that their older brother was the all-star and they were always second. I mean, they get to be the ones that are championed and believed in and loved in. So that's what I hope you experience that. And then the... This is kind of the big thing at the end. Preach grace. Preach grace. These are high-achieving people for whom everything they do is measured. Everything they do is measured. If they're on an athletic team, they know exactly where they fall. If they're in a classroom, they know exactly where they are. Everything is tested and responded, and they have really good awareness on where they land on just about every scale. And so what they need to hear is when you come into worship, there's no scale, there's no grading, there's no judgment, and God is the one who extends grace to you again and again and again and again. So that if you fail in your struggle to get sober or stop using porn or talk to your parents, it's all good. We're going to try it again. We're going to try it again. Because this isn't about you getting some sort of spiritual GPA. This is about learning how to live a life under grace of a God who loves you and really doesn't care if you failed algebra in high school and hate math and, you know, really doesn't care that your French exam you got a C and thought you were going to get, like, he really, like, he cares because he loves you, but, you know, it doesn't matter to him. It doesn't affect how he loves you. And that is just so important to really give them grace. So questions, comments, thoughts, ponderings in this last minute that we have together? Yes?
I guess, there's very little that we can do to, like, control other people, said.
Unfortunately, yes.
You know, you obviously have a really good relationship and that love and the rest, is there a way to, or do you just have to leave it up to God?
Yeah, you know, we have to realize that we built a church system that works really well for some people and not for others, right? And even time of day. So there's a reason Loft is Sunday nights at 8, yeah. Right? And so if you talk about young adults, particularly people who graduate from college and then try and go and find a church home, well, if they've got friends who say, hey, we're going away for the weekend, and if their response is, well, I need to be back Sunday morning at 11 because that's when I have church, that immediately distances them from the social group. But if you could say, hey, we actually have another service Sunday night, or we've got a service Wednesday, and that counts, right? Some of us come from traditions where things have to count. And then you have to teach your congregation that it's okay for people to come wearing jeans. It's okay. Like, I say to my students all the time, like, I have my Facebook page, Pastor Mary, in case you want. And I'll put on there, like, Loft tonight, come in your sweats, right? Just come as you are. I don't care. And I grew up in a tradition where how you showed up on Sunday morning mattered a great deal. Like, we washed our cars on Saturday night, right? Can I have a witness, right? It was... You wash your car on Saturday night, and the parents looked at all the children, and we had a certain way in which we entered the pew, right? That was my childhood. And so the night before I preached, I was like, here, just, that was yesterday. Paul Ryan, our chaplain for worship, the young man who led so well, he texted me and he said, "Hey, I want you to know I'm not dressing up tomorrow. I'm wearing dark jeans." And I said, "Oh," I said, "what are the students wearing? Like, what are the?" He said, "I think everyone's wearing the nice jeans." And I was like, "All right, great," because I was going to wear a suit, but I want to be with you. Like, you're my people. I want to compliment you. I want to be part of the team. And so, so preached in jeans. Like, so the action that I take is, I'm changing for you. You don't have to change for me. So Monday through Friday, or Tuesday through Friday, I don't work Mondays. I'm usually often in a suit, right? I mean, you guys see me, right? I wear dress clothes. I'm in a suit. I'm in meetings. I got my name tag, right? But Sunday nights, it's this often what you saw. Like, I'll preach in this because it's like I want you to feel so safe in this space. So that's, and that takes a lot. I mean, that really takes a lot. But if a congregation is serious about really reaching the next generation, who, by the way, are the leaders of the church right now, and they're leading by saying there are things we're going to do and things we're not going to do, we need to be intentional about this. If you, if you're a podcast person, Will Williman has a podcast. He was the dean of the chapel at Duke University for many years. He's now the bishop of Alabama Methodist Church. He has some great things to say about reaching young people. If you just go through his podcast lists, there's one about young evangelicals in today's church, which is just great. And he talks about having old people go hang out in bars because that's where young adults are. And, I mean, let's be honest, old people have hung out in bars, okay, just probably 40, 50 years ago. So a lot of people actually who are 60 and over are very comfortable in a bar. They're very comfortable at a concert. So if you want to reach young adults, these are the places you go. You go to the coffee shop, you know, you learn how to work a smartphone, like you get a Facebook account. Like, this is what you do. If you're serious about this, you change. And if you're not serious about it, well, you die. Because these are the people who are inheriting our church. I'm your advocates, people. Yes?
How much teaching do you do during preaching?
How much teaching do I do during preaching? I don't know. I've never evaluated it that way. I think y'all get stuff. I think they learn a lot. It really depends on how much I think they know about the context. So when I'm, if I had to learn a lot in order to get to the aha moment, then I know that they're going to have to learn a lot to get to the aha moment. And so what I want to do is take them with me and say, here's what I learned this week about David, or here's what I learned this week about Hebrew, and this is really interesting, and this is really cool, and this is why it makes a difference. They, yeah.
It seems to me some professor of mine once said, teaching is preaching without grace.
Ooh, teaching is preaching without grace. Oh, I was going to say, that was a really good quote. Oh, maybe it is. Yeah, which is actually why I don't like being a preaching professor, is because you always had to evaluate and judge and grade, and I just wanted to encourage and love and be happy. Seriously, those of you who had me as a preaching professor, it's like, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Wasn't my best season of life, so... We are past our time, and I really want to honor it. If you want to hang out, you're welcome to. I know some of you have to go. I'll be happy to hang out and chat, answer questions. Could you thank my students with me? I love my students. Yeah. Go in peace.